Hi, and welcome back to Activists of Tech, the Responsible Tech Podcast. We now know that power and technology are intertwined and led to the rise of techno-oligarchy in the United States. Beyond structural impacts on democracy and the power structure that allowed this to happen, I wondered if democratic governance of technology was even possible, considering this power structure and the intense lobbying from big tech companies, their wealth, and also the inevitability rhetoric that they push. Beyond that, I wanted to talk with an expert about the impacts on gender minorities like women and non-binary people, as well as other marginalized communities. To answer these questions and tell us some dad jokes, I am welcoming Dr. Mar Hicks, an associate professor with tenure at the University of Virginia in the School of Data Science. Dr. Hicks is a historian of technology, gender, and modern Europe, working on the history of women in computing and technology-powered inequalities. Dr. Hicks has published two books recently that are available everywhere. The first one is titled Program Inequality, How Britain Discarded Women Technologists and Lost Its Edge in Computing, and the most recent one titled Your Computer is on Fire, a book on the inequality, marginalization, and biases in our technological systems. I hope you enjoy this episode. Dr. Mar Hicks, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Can you bring everyone up to speed and explain what is the relationship between power and technology?
That's a great question. And the way I see it is that technologies are very useful, right? And the whole reason they're useful is because they're force multipliers. Essentially, what a technology does usually is that it concentrates power through mechanistic or sort of process means into the hands of a person or a group of people who wouldn't have been able to accomplish that same end without that technology, or maybe wouldn't have been able to accomplish it as quickly or as well. And, you know, generally that sounds like a very good thing, but whenever you have a force multiplier, whenever you have something that can concentrate power, that can get problematic depending on how it's used.
How would you explain the rise of techno-oligarchy in the United States? What kind of power structure allowed it to emerge or re-emerge? And do you think it is a model of governance that's going to spread beyond borders?
Yeah, I think that what's happening right now with the enormous power of technology corporations and the people who head them in the United States, and also to a certain extent globally, is that this inherent property of technology to be something that can concentrate power, it's been abused by a lot of people. And we started out in the United States, you know, a few decades ago with this idea that the web was going to democratize things and that technologies that allowed us to become more connected were in fact going to have a leveling effect, a democratizing effect. And really the opposite has happened in a lot of ways. In a lot of ways, it's allowed a very, very small subset of people to gain enormous wealth. And with that, they've increasingly gained political power. They've really almost come to compete with the power of entire nations, some of these enormously wealthy companies and the people who run them. And so I don't think it's a strict model of governance as such, but we are seeing something emerge that's similar to what happened in other periods of our history in the United States, like in the Gilded Age, where people who were very wealthy industrialists, you know, they gained similar levels of power that allowed them a level of privilege in shaping everything that was happening in society, from workers' rights to how the country should run. And we're sort of seeing that again. And I do think there is evidence that it is spreading beyond the borders of the US because countries are always interdependent. You know, we're interdependent in the global economy, we're interdependent in ways that you know, the politics of certain countries affect the politics of those around them, or even politics of countries around the globe. So as things, you know, go, I don't want to say go wrong, but essentially as things go wrong in one country, other countries, of course, have to be responding to that and be cognizant of how they're going to deal with that.
Since we're at it, do you think that change and innovation through technology is actually possible, or because of our like social and historic context, isn't it just going to be the continuation of an unfair status quo?
You know, in my most pessimistic moments, I think, oh, what if that's most of what technological change is doing? But generally, I'm more of an optimist because I do think technologies have allowed, a great many people, myself included, to do everything from live longer lives to have better quality of life. There is always that pressure to. That we have to kind of push against, that technologies often make things terribly, terribly uneven and unequal. But to just give some examples where, technological change has been really, really positive, there are medical technologies now that impact, I would say, almost all of us in the United States, especially public health technologies, which unfortunately are starting to be torn down right now. But for many decades, there have been public health technologies that have allowed fewer children to die, more people to make it to adulthood without having, major childhood illnesses that leave them dead or disabled. We have, very basic but incredibly important technologies like sanitary sewers that allow people to not get sick when they're, drinking the water. And then we have, going along with more medical technologies, there are all sorts of medical technologies that are deployed to ensure that people who maybe wouldn't have been able to survive certain things in the past now are. Now, this is not, an uncomplicated thing. There's, for-profit healthcare in the United States. And so a lot of these, especially high-end medical technologies, are not available equally to everybody. So it's by no means a perfect system. But I would say that there are a lot of examples that we can look to where we see technologies that have improved people's lives. And so it's really about democratic governance of technological change and ensuring that technologies respond to what the great mass of people need them to respond to and do. And it's that political piece really that's important. It's not that most technological changes are necessarily going to be destructive and problematic, although of course some are. There are weapons technologies that it's very, very hard to find any sort of way that you can say that this incredibly destructive weapons technology is going to be a net positive for most people. But that's how I tend to look at it. I am not a total pessimist.
And I love that for you. Can't relate 100%, but I like to hear that perspective of hope. A question that I have from what you just said is, do you think that democratic governance of technologies is possible with the amount of money that big tech companies spend on lobbying efforts within governments?
That is really the crux of it. Is democratic governance possible given the way that we have this situation where there's huge, huge disparities of wealth and power? And I think that the answer is yes, it is possible, but with a caveat that the system needs to change. We have a system right now in the United States, and it's like this in many other countries, where our governance structures are democratic, but they are not adequately responsible to the will of the people. People do not feel like their voices are being heard. In many cases, their voices and votes aren't being adequately heard. And that is a big reason that we have the problems that we have right now. So it is going to require political change and structural change, not just technological change.
What do you think is the impact of tech oligarchy on gender minorities like women and non-binary people, as well as other marginalized communities? And by that, I mean the culture that spreads from having power concentrated in the hands of a few men and carried in the technologies and narrative that surrounds literally anybody else.
Yeah, the farther away someone is or a group of people are from sort of the centers of power and influence, the less taken into account they are in anything that happens, in any changes that develop. To just give one example, recently there are a lot of people talking about issues of harassment online and how people can, essentially protect themselves from harassment, surveillance, stalking, as a result of all of these technologies that have been built up over the past few decades that allow us to be more present in virtual spaces and more communicative with each other online. There's all of this abuse that occurs. And this is something that women and minoritized groups have been warning about and talking about because it was happening to them decades and decades ago from the beginning of, the World Wide Web as we know it. And it's only something that's really become important, or I would say discussed in a way that it's seen as important in maybe the past few years as a general concern. And that's just one example of how critical it is to pay attention to people who are farther away from these centers of technological power or even political power, because eventually what comes for them in a bad way comes for everybody in a bad way. And it might be slow, it might be fast, but historically it will 100% happen. And the only way to insulate yourself from that is if you're going to be one of the, 0.1% who's really at the top controlling everything. And that is, of course, not the situation of nearly every single person in the country or on the planet.
So to clarify, we have all more chances to become the victims of tech billionaires than to become their buddies and like become them, right?
100%, yes.
Thank you. So what more broad societal impacts do tech billionaires actually pose in terms of systemic injustices and inequalities?
Well, I think that, just by virtue of being wealthier than most people are even able to understand on a basic level, it's very hard, I think, for normal people to even conceptualize how much money that actually is, $1 billion. And these are now multi billionaires in most cases. They are completely divorced from and disconnected any of the concerns that the rest of us have. They are thinking about, pie in the sky, moonshot type things like going to Mars or never dying. They are simply not concerned with life on Earth in the way that the great mass of people are and have to be. And I would argue, should be, because we are all living on Earth, and that is going to be our situation for the rest of our lives. So the social impacts that they're having are just to essentially upend and harm all of the systems that are in place that serve most people, but maybe don't serve them. Or in some cases, those systems actually do serve them. They provide like incredibly valuable infrastructure that allows them to make their billions. But because they're so divorced from essentially, the reality of the situation, they don't even recognize or care about that anymore. And so it's really like having, just an absolute wild card in the mix. And maybe that's not even a good analogy, because at least in the case of a wild card, you're playing the same game. We're not even playing the same card game anymore.
I mean, I agree with you, but at the same time, I'm like, don't you think that the narrative of the American dream, that is like, oh, if you work really, really hard, you too can become the next tech billionaire, really impacts the way people react seeing these incredibly wealthy people and don't really see how problematic that is?
Oh, yeah, I think that's incredibly problematic. And I think that that is a fair critique. I will also say, however, that the American dream, as I understood it, and part of my family are immigrants, The American dream was never become a billionaire. The American dream was to get away from somewhere else where you were persecuted, to get away from somewhere else where you were subsistence farming. It was to go somewhere where you could have a fair shot and have a level of quality of life and a level not even of wealth, but just of stability where you could have a good life. That was the American dream. The American dream, it only recently transmogrified into this idea that you become wealthier than God and you use it to stamp out all who oppose you. That was never the American dream in, for the periods I was growing up. And the American dream we were sold, work hard and you'll sort of get yours. That was always problematic itself because there are huge inequities and structural issues that make it so that certain people can do that and certain people either can't do that or they're going to have a way, way harder time getting to, a lower rung on the socioeconomic ladder. So I'm not saying that even the version I stated was, not problematic in a lot of ways, but it wasn't this bizarre, nightmarish version where you have working class people somehow feeling like they have more in common with billionaires than they do with their fellow people in their communities.
Well, that's actually really interesting because if I mean I did not grow up in the United States. What I've seen online for the past, I would say 5, 6, maybe 10 years, it was really this idea of the American dream: become the wealthiest person that you can, become a billionaire. When you lived there, right? Did you grow up in the United States as well?
I did. And I would say that, what you're describing, this sort of what I would say, I don't know, like kind of distortion of what maybe was a slightly nicer idea. I mean, that did start a long time ago. Like I, just based on my age, in the 80s, we were seeing the whole greed is good. But back then, with the 80s and the Wall Street tycoons and everything, there was still this understanding, I think, on the part of most people that that was A, not available to most people, and B, a shitty thing to do. People didn't look very kindly on that in general. They didn't look up to those people unless they were in a very sort of specific strata of society where they were already kind of adjacent to, these day traders on Wall Street where, they might actually be in their social circles. And I think you're 100% right that over the ensuing decades, it's just become honestly weirder and weirder with people kind of using this hyper individualistic lens to more and more separate themselves from the concerns of their communities and society as a whole, and to lionize people who do that and get enormously wealthy, hit the jackpot in ways that simply are not ever going to happen for nearly 100% of the population.
Would you happen to know what triggered this cultural shift?
I would love to have a good, quick answer to that, but I don't know if I do. I think that a lot of it is just the accretion of different things that happened in US history that sort of gave people the subtle and not so subtle message that, look, you're in it alone, kind of. We, in many ways, got atomized by the way that our suburbs and cities expanded in a geographical sense. There was, of course, enormous racial division throughout the 20th century, which continues. There are all sorts of things that have happened socially, geographically, and also economically, with the poor getting poorer and the rich getting richer, that leads to certain kinds of really unhelpful magical thinking where a lot of people think, well, I don't see anything for me in my community, so I'm just gonna kind of dream big and fantasize about what if something pulls me out of it. And that is maybe where we get some people who are aligning with those who have no idea that they even exist instead of caring about the, community they're in and the people right around them. But I don't have a great answer to that. It's definitely due to how our political and economic structures are set up in this country and how they've kind of divided people economically and really destroyed the middle class that we used to have. But there's no one simple answer to, well, here's the smoking gun that started the whole cascade. But that's sort of the general answer I would give.
I mean, I think that's a great answer. And yeah, what a mess. What a mess they've made. So how can we clean that mess? How can everyday people resist techno-oligarchy?
Well, I think that one of the things we really have to keep in mind as ordinary people is that we're told things by people in power, like this is how it's going to go. We don't necessarily have to go along with it, or at least in a democracy, we don't necessarily have to go along with it. And that extends to, technology companies that are saying, oh, this technology is going to be the next big thing. This is the thing that you're all going to have to use, or else you'll lose your jobs, you'll get left behind, et cetera, and so forth. We're seeing this inevitability rhetoric a lot with AI now, but we've seen it in the past again and again with lots and lots of technologies that have come along. And a lot of those technologies have actually failed. They're not with us today. So this is a marketing strategy. This is something that serves companies' interests. It is not something that is real, and it is not something that we have to or should go along with. So one of the things that ordinary people can do is to simply, think twice and not just uncritically adopt technologies that are doing harmful things like stealing a lot of people's work and intellectual property, making our energy bills go up, making environmental problems that we already have with water and pollution worse and worse. There are no good reasons, honestly, that people should jump to start using technologies that corporations say are going to be the next big thing. Now, there's this kind of Pandora's box effect, right? And this curiosity that leads people to at least want to look at it or play around with it. But we have to understand, I think, as consumers, how skillfully that has been leveraged against us over the years, and the way free trials, they always say, well, a lot of people say, if you're getting something for free, it's not free. You're the product, or you're providing the labor. And I think that we really have to think about these issues of how we consent to being within the technological systems we're in. Now, some of these systems are inescapable, or nearly so. Some of these systems we simply must engage with in order to do things like go to work or make money or get medical care. But the ones that aren't, or the ones that aren't yet, it always helps if we can slow things down a bit. A speeding freight train that's going to kill a bunch of people anyway when it crashes, it doesn't necessarily mean that there's no value in slowing it down, right? Because even if it wrecks more slowly, fewer people are going to die. We don't have total control, but we do have some control. We do have some agency. And the more that we have an understanding of that, and then also like practice that, not just alone, but in concert with the people that we work with, in concert that the people that we live in community with, we can make a lot of change, especially on the state and local level. Some of the most important laws that I've seen so far regarding not allowing surveillance technologies to completely overrun communities, in terms of saying that like mental health practitioners shouldn't be using AI instead of talking to their patients. These are coming from city and state level. And people do have power to get involved at those levels in ways that are, of course, strenuous, but they're not impossible. Like people do that every day. And it's difficult sometimes and it's frustrating, but it's one of the ways that we can make a big difference for ourselves and, the communities that we're living in and spending the most time in.
Yeah, I completely agree. So I'm not sure how to transition towards the the light part of the episode. But also because it's a very heavy topic, and we either end with hope or something funny. And you're known for your dad jokes. I've seen your blue sky feed. It does brighten my day. So, what's your best dad joke, if you have one, related to this topic, so that we can just, I feel like if we laugh about them, it just kind of remove also power from them.
I think that's really true. And I don't know if these jokes will make anybody laugh, but I'll tell them anyway.
Okay,
Happy
and
to.
go for it.
Okay, so let's see, technology related dad jokes. Well, one is, do you know why swords never go out of fashion?
No.
Well, it's because they're cutting edge technologies.
That's actually really good.
And let's see, I think I have one more technology
Okay.
related one. How many computer programmers does it take to change a light bulb?
Oh my God. I don't know.
Well, none. That's a hardware problem.
That was good. That was good. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you for asking. I like to take any chance I can to inflict dad jokes on people.
I we appreciate it. We really like it. Would you like to promote your book actually that you published?
Sure. Yeah. If people want to read more about my work offline, I have a book called Programmed Inequality, which is all about gendered labor change in the history of computing, and another book that I'm a co-editor, co-author of called with a cheery title, Your Computer is on Fire. And that's actually that might be interesting to folks if they're kind of just getting into this topic that we've been talking about today, because it's a little bit more about the history of how we got here. How did we get to this point where it seems sort of like things are on fire technologically in a lot of ways, or techno-socially?
Thank you so much.
Thank you. This is great.